So part of my title of my talk was The Age of Data. I wanted to say a little bit about that to get us started. If you think about how the activity of science is conducted, it's often broken into two pieces, which is theory and modeling, in which mostly the mathematics takes place, and mathematics has overlapped with it. But also there's this element of observation and experimentation that takes place. It's most pronounced, I think, in physicists who want to build these grandiose facilities for doing their experiments, but it takes place all throughout science. And after the computer became so prominent, there was this other activity that takes place in the scientific endeavor, which is computation and simulation. We can use computers to simulate lots of things, and these things play off against each other. I actually spend time dabbling in each of these kinds of activities and what I do. But I think that there's some major things happening to change the fundamentally how science is being done. And if you think back, I like to take a historical view on things. I actually went with my wife today to the American History Museum because I like looking at history. And I like going back and reading old masters in a field, too. So when I started getting interested in economics, I went to read all the Nobel Prize winners' acceptance speeches. It's a great way to get started in economics. But there's sort of these major themes that occur throughout history. Mechanization of farming was a big one, right? All of a sudden, when a few people could use machines to produce all of the food for society, then others are freed of the responsibility to forage for food. It had a huge effect on society. The Industrial Revolution, of course, was another one, where all of a sudden products could be produced at great scale. And it caused people to move to cities together with the mechanization of farming. Had huge impact on society. And of course, since I work at Google, you would think that I would also mention this information revolution, but I'm sure that each of you is keenly aware of the fact that the information revolution is really changing how society functions. And there was this first emergence of the service economy after the war, when all of a sudden there were more people working in services than were working in manufacturing. That was sort of the beginning of it. But then computation started gaining its influence as well, and Moore's law fueling the acceleration of computation so that all of a sudden we could do many, many more things. Then there was this sort of minor revolution that took place with the popularization of the internet and the development of the World Wide Web. The changes that this has brought in our society touch almost everything that we have. It touches business, it touches politics, it touches personal relationships. It's touching essentially everything. But it's also touching science. And there's another aspect of this information revolution, which I think is sort of underappreciated, but is very strongly present in the kind of work I'm going to talk about, which is it's the era of data, because as computers have increased in their speed, disk capacities have also increased at a corresponding rate. And there's this thing that's sometimes called Kreider's Law. Kreider was a guy at Seagate. There's a lot of argument about what this law should look like. This is one example showing disk capacity on the right-hand axis and time on the lower axes. And you can see this is a logarithmic scale, right? So there's a definite rapid increase in capacity. And this is another view on it. This is looking at number of bits you can store in a square inch of recordable media. There's a clear trend here that the amount of data that can be stored is just growing astronomically. And this is one of the things that's changing science. I actually found this very interesting study, which was about, it was done by the storage industry, so they were trying to estimate the size of the market and this sort of thing. And I went and read this thing, and this guy actually tried to analyze how much data was being recorded to magnetic disk. And he came up with this figure of 160 exabytes in 2006. Now, an exabyte is not one of those numbers you throw around every day, but we didn't used to throw around terabytes or gigabytes either. So there's a megabyte, a gigabyte, a terabyte. What's next? A petabyte. And an exabyte is 1,000 petabytes. Right. So in 2010, he predicted that we will have 1,000 exabytes being recorded to disk. Now, what's most interesting about this is in the study, he pointed out that 70% of this data that's being recorded to disk is as a result of a direct human action. And I think that's one of the most interesting things contained in this study, actually, that a lot of that is coming from the digital imaging devices. I mean, I'm carrying two cameras in my pocket, right? The number of cameras that are in the world is just incredible now. And a lot of that is just people taking pictures of all sorts of different things. But also there's these emerging sensor networks. There's a huge amount of data being gathered. And this has some implications for scientific computation and the role of mathematics within scientific computation because of two things, I think. One, because 70% of this data is taking place as a result of direct human action, this is actually going to increase interest in the social sciences in looking at the social implications of this data. And I give some examples here. Cognitive science is one that I'm actually going to talk about a little bit today. Economics, which you mentioned the anecdote about Hal Varian looking at being able to predict unemployment claims, which is actually the best leading indicator for the end of the recession, as it turns out, which is why there's keen interest in that. Also in sociology, how people interact. And so there'll be increasing interest in the mathematics surrounding these. But it also gives us increased ability to validate our theoretical models. Now we have all this data that we record about the world around us. We now have the ability to both hypothesize about that and validate the models that we hypothesize. And so what happens is that it's increasing the ties between these and increasing the activities here, both in the simulation, the computation on data. We can now do computations on immense amounts of data, but also we're doing direct observations of humans. Of course, a lot of that has some privacy implications, but we're keenly aware of that at Google because we're gathering information about the searches, which are often very personal to these humans, right? But you can infer a lot from that information. So let me talk about this DIKW hierarchy a little bit. This is just to get you to think about the nature of information and data that's being recorded. How should you reason about it? How should you model it? So at the lowest level, you could just think of data, raw bits, raw symbols being recorded. And that's not very interesting. Computer scientists might be interested in that, but it's not so interesting for others, I think. When the interest starts to come in is when you start thinking about what's contained within that information. So at the information layer, you talk about symbols with relationships, the fact that E is perhaps more common than Z in human language. And so that this is the kind of layer where a lot of information theory takes place, for example. Above that is the knowledge layer, where people are trying to extract information from information that is at a higher semantic layer. So when you see the letter E, for example, as a mathematics audience, you might think it's a mathematical constant. It has a special meaning associated with it. It's not just something that occurs more often, but it also has some real meaning behind it, some knowledge behind it. In a physics audience, it might mean something slightly different, but it's contextual. And above that, there's also this wisdom layer, which is even harder to define, but it's something that people think about in information science quite a bit. This is a sort of what kind of inference can you make on the basis of this knowledge, and what can be done with it. It's extrapolative, and it's non-deterministic, it's contextual. But I think it's important to distinguish that there are different kinds of activities that go on in modeling in these different layers. So in particular, in this layer that I have done some work in of search, this field is really called information retrieval. That is the problem of search, the science behind what makes good search. And so when you see this, you probably have this Pavlovian dog reaction to type something into that to see what you can find. Yes. But there's a process going on there. There's a cognitive process. What happens is the user comes to us when they have some information need of some type. They then translate that using their context into something which is a query, which is a short language description of what idea they have in their head through some cognitive process. They type that in here, they give it to us, then we have to infer from that very short description what exactly is going to be helpful to them to answer their original information need. And it's very complicated to model these things. There's a lot of different signals we use to model these things. The science behind it is actually fairly well undeveloped, I think, and it's changing rather rapidly. Well, it's one of the reasons I got interested in this field. In particular, it's not at all clear how to model these transformations as we go along. By the way, you might ask, why do we actually insist on having a short query? That's partly for computer science reasons. It turns out that what happens when you build an index is you take your documents, you create document term pairs, you invert those and you sort by term so that when somebody gives you a term, you can look up which documents contain that term. And you can do it very rapidly, so it's an efficient data structure for doing that. But it's purely an artifact of the fact that we can build that, we know how to build that, we know how to do algorithms on it. But it's not clear that this is actually the optimal way to do it. Some people have said, why don't you type full language questions in there? But that turns out not to be so efficient on a phone. It's kind of hard to type on those. So I think there's a lot of trade-off there. So this question about, let's take an example here. Which web pages are relevant for the query mathematics? Just to take a random example for this audience. So you might think maybe it's pages that contain the term more often. If they talk about it more often, then maybe it's more central to the document. You might think it's pages that contain mathematics in the title, because then that says something about what the document is about. Or maybe you would look at this and you say, oh, well, this is the thing named mathematics, so maybe that's the thing that actually is the thing you should return for it. Well, it's not at all clear what you should do. You need some kind of mathematical model to tell you what things are actually likely to be the good ones. Turns out that last one is not the one that you should look at. And I really love this quote. I try to use this in talks occasionally whenever I can find an appropriate time for it. The one, www.mathematics.org, to an untrained eye, you might think that means something, and that would be good. But it turns out to be what we call a parked domain. So in the gold rush of the internet, somebody registered that domain, is holding on to it, hoping somebody will buy it. And it's just complete and utter nonsense. It has no value to it because they haven't put any effort into it. So it turns out that's actually kind of fundamental to what we do in trying to build a good search engine. And it's fundamental to how you build a mathematical model, that there are actually adversaries involved in this game. And I used to describe what I do as adversarial computer science, because you always have to have in your mind that there's somebody else with a goal that's not completely aligned to your goal, and you should try to take that into account. So if you look at what are the success criteria in information retrieval, there's sort of two traditional ones. They're called precision and recall. Precision is, are the documents that are being returned really relevant to the original query, the original information need? The second one is recall. Did you actually find all the relevant documents that the user was looking for? So those are the two measures you can think about. However, with a glut of information, if you actually type in the query mathematics, there's something like 100 million pages that mention the word mathematics. So actually, the recall is not quite what you need. It's not of great value to return the user, here's 100 million documents, why don't you sort these out and see what's useful in there for you. So what happens is that ranking is actually the one that becomes more important than recall for this popular kind of query. And so there's sort of three methods by which you assess the quality of it. Let me say a little bit about one of the mathematical models that's used for information retrieval, and that is a probabilistic model. There's actually many variations in this model, and I'm only giving a broad sketch of it. But the basic idea is you think of these processes of selecting an information need, from that information need constructing a query, and from that seeing what's relevant. So these are somehow could be modeled as sampling from a sample space according to some probability distribution. So it turns out on weekends people are more likely to pull out the word sex as a query than on the weekdays. So there is actually some distribution that's not uniform here. And so there's going to be some distribution on the queries. And then you can also talk about what is the probability that given a document, that document is actually relevant to the query. It could be that some term may have some very distant relationship to the query. So for some user, it might actually be relevant, but you can associate a probability to that. So what we try to estimate is we would try to estimate the probability that a document is relevant if you're given a query. And if you rank by this probability, that would give you a good ranking. So the question is, what does this look like? Well, of course, as a mathematician, you have another one of those Pavlov dog reactions, and you try to apply Bayes' rule and turn it around, so maybe you can get something more sensible out of it. And, of course, if you do this, you write down some terms here. So let's look at these terms a little bit. First of all, there's the denominator, the probability that a query would be selected. Well, for the purposes of ranking, that one actually doesn't matter because the query is fixed for ranking for all the documents for a given query. So that one you could just sort of ignore for ranking purposes right now. Although it's interesting for other kinds of things, it's not particularly relevant here. Now, these other terms, there's a static distribution here which actually does not depend on the query, and that's kind of interesting. What could that possibly be? Well, it turns out that what Google was founded upon was a technique which would try to figure out what that probability distribution should be. There's something called PageRank, which gives a query-independent distribution across all documents, independent of what the query is. And then the hard part comes down to, what is this term here? So that you can think of as, given a document, what is the likelihood that a process which generates queries from this document would have generated the query that you actually were given? And so That one is a different kind of process, and so most of the work in search goes into actually trying to model what that probability distribution is, and there are various kinds of models that can be looked at. If I just say a word about this this thing here, this is probably the thing you've heard talked about in Google for an application of mathematics, is the thing of PageRank. The idea, the basic idea behind this is you can think of the World Wide Web as a directed graph in which the vertices are the URLs, or the web pages, and the edges between the URLs are simply the hyperlinks that lead from one page to another. So if you thought about this as a directed graph and you imagined that a random surfer was just surfing around on the web and following these links, so at each step they would get to a page and they would select one of the outbound links and they would follow that link and go to a new page. So they're just performing a random walk on the World Wide Web. And under conditions on that graph, there may or may not be a unique stationary distribution for this Markov chain induced by this random walk. And you can actually prove that it's easy to construct this kind of thing. If you make a slight modification to the random walk, you can actually guarantee that a unique distribution exists. You calculate that unique stationary distribution on this gigantic graph, and that gives you sort of an expected probability that a user would be at a page if they were just walking randomly around on the web. Now, since links were thought to convey some kind of authority, people typically would create a link from one page to another and say, you might want to go there. It's some conveyance of authority. If you follow those kind of links, you're more likely to go to pages that actually are better quality, it was thought. And that actually worked very well in the days 10 years ago when Google was being founded, and that was the basis of the company. As it turns out, the web is kind of a dynamic thing, though. Where I said links used to convey authority, they don't anymore, really. What happened was PageRank was sort of discovered, it was outed to the world, and the people who have an interest in actually manipulating search results learned exactly how to go and manipulate it, so the mathematics actually has to adapt and keep up with it. This is some of what we call our secret sauce. It's not stuff that we actually talk about, in part because we don't want to get in this kind of war again. But luckily I have other mathematics to talk about here, so that I don't really need to pursue that one. But it is actually quite an interesting area to look at. And it's nice that we actually came up with an application for Markov chains, where it'd be interesting to calculate stationary distributions. By the way, I should say that I think it was last year we announced that we had discovered a trillion URLs in our crawl. That's a big number, a trillion. So we're talking about calculating a stationary distribution on a random walk on a graph that has a trillion vertices. That is a big computational problem to do. It can be done, but it's a challenge. So here again is another example. I chose discrete mathematics this time, betraying a little bias on my part, I guess. But you know, if you type a query like this and you get some results and it looks to me like we're doing okay, perhaps you could think of a result we're missing here. I've only shown you three results here, and I'm not showing the ads on the right-hand side, which actually have a lot of interesting mathematics associated with them, too. But I'm actually not going to talk specifically about the ranking function we apply for this, but a variation on this ranking function, which is actually pretty interesting. And that is, today's topic is actually on what happens when you click on this little link here that says similar. So many of you have probably not clicked on that, because we actually had a long period when we trained users not to click on that by giving them really bad results. So it was very effective, I must say, but I've worked on this recently, and I would claim that it's actually better now than it used to be. So in that particular example, that was for a discrete mathematics journal. If you click on that, for example, now you'll actually see things that I think are quite reasonable. You clicked on something, what's similar to a result which was a discrete mathematics journal, and we're showing things that actually look pretty close to similar to that. And so somehow something looks like it's working for us. So if you looked at the quality in 2006, which is when I went back to look at this, this is not the discrete mathematics example. This is the what is related to the Wikipedia page for the word Gorgonzola. I love this phrase because it's so good to construct queries out of that. And we were showing what I would say is unrelated. It was horrible. So we trained users in this process not to click on it. They click on it, they get this, like, what's that? That's nonsense. So I went back to look at this and I said, I should be able to improve this problem. And I learned something in the process of that. You should actually never volunteer for a job until you know exactly what the job involves. And I regret it a little bit later. Let's take another example, which is unrelated to mathematics. So I'll challenge you to think about it just a little bit differently. So this is an example, which is GatorFarm.com, which it turns out is a farm in Colorado where they actually raise alligators. Now, first of all, there's something completely strange about that, because alligators cannot live in Colorado. It gets well below freezing in Colorado, and they're cold-blooded. So you have to be a little bit suspicious that this place could even exist. I was driving in Colorado one time, and my wife and I came across this, and I'm driving across this valley, in the San Luis Valley in southern Colorado, and I was like, alligator farm? That's impossible. I had to go to this place, so I know a little bit about this place. But think about, if you're trying to find what pages are related to this, what does it even mean to find pages that are related to this? What concept are we actually trying to capture here? It is not completely clear, in fact. So what happens is that this is a page that involves multiple kinds of topics. So it involves gators, perhaps reptiles as an instance of gators. It is, in fact, like a zoo. People go there in the same way they go to the zoos to observe the animals. They actually will sell you a bucket of Purina alligator chow. I didn't even know there was such a thing. But they'll sell you a bucket of Purina alligator chow, and you walk out there shaking this bucket, and the alligators all stand up and start walking toward you to get fed. But it is sort of like a zoo. It's an entertainment facility, basically. But they also sell meat there. It's also a place in Colorado for tourism. Now, what aspects of this would you select in trying to decide what is similar to this? It is not completely obvious. So if you're trying to define this in some mathematical way, I think you have to have an idea of what does a document represent. A document can be thought of in some ways as capturing certain topics and tying them together some way. At some semantic layer, it's tying together some topics. And you can think of these perhaps as individual dimensions that you might head off in. If you were to think of documents as being embedded in some geometric space, they might be directions that you could head off in. Yes?
Could you consider them to be objects with descriptors, variables?
Yes, you could. Stay tuned. I'm going to say a lot more about this. So this problem about what is a related document is exactly what we're trying to get after. So documents have these multiple topics. And you could ask yourself, what is a topic? What defines a topic? And there's a problem that these documents are expressed in language, and language is inherently inaccurate. It has these two particular problems of synonymy and parsimony. That is that a single term can have multiple meanings, and a single concept can have multiple terms to represent it, like car and auto could refer to essentially the same topic. And so it's a little bit complicated by that, but there are some, at some semantic layer, there are topics that we're trying to infer from this. But it's even a little bit more complicated than that, because it turns out that we don't want documents that are too similar. As it turns out, about 40% of the document of the World Wide Web is replicated. There are multiple copies out there. And in our process of building an index, we actually try to remove all of those duplicates. So an exact duplicate is not actually of high value. It's like the thing that's most similar to the original document, but it has little utility to the user. So we should not show that. And in fact, we have a process by which we try to eliminate near duplicate documents, whatever near duplicate means. But you can imagine, like, if a page has a day of the week in the upper right-hand thing, then that changes all the time, or a time stamp, or a page counter for a number of hits. These things change, but they're not substantial enough to really make it different. So we try to eliminate near duplicates, in fact. So this greatly complicates it, and it adds to this confusion about it's not clear exactly what similarity means. There's some unknown objective function going on here, but we don't actually know what that objective function is. We're trying to provide the user with something that will be of value to them that's on the topic that they were looking at, but not too close. But we can luckily measure this objective function, because what happens is we can try something, show them this set of results by this algorithm, and see if they click on it. So we can have them tell us, are we actually fulfilling their objective function. So luckily, that's something we don't need a complete mathematical model for. We can sort of remove that from the equation by doing experimentation. There's a little bit of the algorithmic problem here, too. If you have a trillion documents, I don't actually want to calculate a linear ordering on all of the documents to say which ones are most similar to this one. I don't really care. Once you get past 10 or 30 or something, I don't care. I just want the top k for some small k. So from an algorithmic point of view, I can reduce the problem. The size of the output will be linear in the size of the input. And We can use some pre-computation in this, but we're not really willing to do much computation at query time, say less than 100 milliseconds. So this greatly constrains the kind of calculations you can do in real time. So it turns out that the thing that was running in 2006, which was working very well in about 2002, was this algorithm by Jeff Dean and Monica Hensinger, and it was called the co-citation approach. And it didn't actually look at the content of the page, believe it or not. It was another example like PageRank, where we use something called link analysis to look strictly at the hyperlinks, the graph structure of the web. So what happened was, if you're trying to decide if these two pages, A and B, are closely related to each other, you have evidence that they're closely related to each other if there's a third page, C, that actually has links to both of them. So that's sort of a signal from page C, from an author, by the way, who's probably independent of the authors of A and B, saying, these two, I'm on some topic, and I can point to these two saying these are related to my topic, whatever it is. So they're tied through a common bound there. And also, if these two pages point to a page in common, then that's another signal that they're actually perhaps related to each other. Now, you can think of lots of false positives in this. You know, these two pages might both point to Amazon, right, but have nothing to do with them, with each other, right? Say, you can, I bought something from Amazon, or you can go buy this from Amazon, or I worked at Amazon, or whatever. So it's kind of a weak signal, and there are lots of false positives in this. And it was working actually pretty well at first, but it was falling apart by about 2006. So I went back to look at this problem, and the problem is that the web link structure is just completely breaking down. It's the same problem as with PageRank. And there are lots of spam links being created. And there's also something about the economic value of the web that's fundamentally conspired against this technique. What happens is there are not many incentives for IBM to put a link to HP. Right? That's just not going to happen, right? They're in the interest of selling to their customers, and they're not going to divert their attention to something which is actually related, but not really in their interests. And so the competitive nature of the web was working against it. So let me talk about one approach to this problem, of another approach to information retrieval, which has been popular in the literature, which is called the vector space model. And this is an idea where you take a document, you think of a document as being embedded in some geometric space, and each document represents a row in some matrix, say, and the value of a coordinate would be the number of times that the term appears. So for each document, there's a relatively small number of terms in the document. You'd have non-zero entries for that document in the places where for the terms that actually appear in the document. So the dimension of this space is the number of possible terms. There's actually a law, I forget whose law this is, it says something like if you have a corpus of about n documents, you expect about square root of n terms in those documents. And so, you might expect to get something like 10 million dimensions or 10 million distinct terms among all the documents on the web. That number is actually off, but for the purpose of this discussion, it's okay. And you've got more than 1 trillion documents. So this is what you call a big vector space, to say the least. It's not the kind of vector space that people in the physical sciences typically want to talk about. It's not the sort of things you want to do linear algebra on, but at least the matrix is sparse, right? So sparse matrices are the sort of things that the linear algebra people like. So one potential similarity measure on this space is you can think of your documents as being these vectors. So what would be if these vectors were shared a lot of terms in common? That would mean that actually they have a small angle between them. So they have a very small cosine distance to measure the distance between these things. So that's a very nice way of thinking about it. It's sort of a natural way for a mathematician to think about it, and something that we're well versed with. You apply geometry and you have a way now that you can reason about whether things are close to each other. It has some obvious problems. It ignores synonymy, so it's also very sensitive to throwing in the word red herring and making a non-zero entry someplace is actually not that important necessarily. So there's a lot of noise in this. It doesn't have any semantic meaning built in. It's just looking strictly at the overlap between documents. It doesn't pay attention to the sequential nature of language, that terms that are next to each other mean something rather than terms that are far-flung in the document. So it has some problems. You can immediately look at it, but it's a good starting point. Now, actually, in the 1980s, someone took this starting point and came up with an idea to try to solve some of the problems associated with it. And this is the idea of latent semantic analysis. That is, you can take your vector space and you can actually project it down to a smaller dimensional vector space. The idea here is that if you reduce the number of dimensions, perhaps what will happen is these terms that are actually closely aligned to each other, that may be synonyms for each other, would get collapsed down upon each other, essentially. So perhaps if you reason in a smaller dimensional vector space, you take your document, project down to the smaller dimensional vector space, look for what's close in that projection, then maybe those would actually be the documents you should be looking at. It has some other things associated with it. By reducing the dimension, it makes it easier to compute with it. And so you may only need the number of dimensions, which is the number of topics that people could be interested in. So you can actually reduce this down considerably. And there's sort of an obvious computational approach to this that's well known in numerical analysis, which would be you'd compute the singular value decomposition, which computes, according to the L2 distance, a sort of optimal low-rank approximation to original vector space. It's optimal in the L2 distance measure, at least. And so there's good mathematical motivation for using this. And we looked at this, and another team looked at this, actually, and decided that that's what they were going to try in 2005. You project down documents into this. Well, it's still not very practical. It's actually a big computational problem. But, you know, we got machines. We can burn cycles on it. So they tried this for a while. They actually did it on a subset of the web, not on the whole web. There's one little problem with this. And this is one of the problems that's endemic to all this kind of applied work. You can have this great sort of mathematical idea. You can try it. And then in the end, you have to look at the results and say, did this actually match reality? So what happened was, actually, the results really sucked. And it was horrible. What happened was it did okay for what's called the tail of the web, sort of the documents that are very jargon-rich and for which the term overlap actually means something. So perhaps homomorphism is a term that doesn't get confused too much, so it'll work pretty well for that, the tail of the web. But if you look at things for, like, what is similar to Best Buy or what is similar to Amazon.com, it actually did horribly for that. So it didn't actually do enough collapsing of those kind of documents. And unfortunately, a lot of our traffic is on these popular parts of the web. One of the use cases for this is, I know about that company, tell me about a competitor to that company. That's one of the potential use cases for users. So that caused me to go back and think about this. Okay, now that was a year wasted working on this thing. So I'm going to try to come in and do this. I better think about this a little bit differently. So it turns out that this concept of similarity has been very hotly debated among psychologists. Now, I never actually before this time had even heard the term mathematical psychologist. I didn't know that such a thing could be constructed in real life. But it turns out that there is a lot of mathematical theory behind this concept of similarity that's been hotly debated. And one of the central issues is a metric space really the right paradigm for thinking about similarity? So we often use language saying this is close to that. It's language that's sort of couched in these distance terms. And so you might think that it's natural to think in those terms. But it turns out that it's not really the right concept to look at. So these are the axioms of a metric space, which will be familiar to every mathematician. And if you go through and look at these one by one, the first example where this started to fall apart actually goes back to the father of psychology, William James, in 1890, where he gave this example of a flame is similar to a moon because both are luminous. They emit light. And a moon is similar to a ball because they're both round. But a flame and a ball are not similar at all. And so what this tells you is that probably the triangle inequality is wrong. Just because these two things are close to each other doesn't mean that these two things are close to each other, right? So there's something really wrong there. You can come up with lots of examples like this. I think another example was Jamaica is like Cuba, and Cuba is like Russia, but you don't think of Jamaica as being like Russia, right? Because they overlap in different ways. Another example was given by this guy, Amos Tversky, who in the 1970s did a lot of experiments to actually ask humans which things they think are more similar to each other. And what he found that often objects were identified as being more similar to something else than itself. And a particular example was that the letter M was more often recognized as an H than recognized as itself, which is completely nuts, right? This just doesn't seem possible. But it turns out that the mind perceives things in ways that are quite unexpected. And so what this says is actually probably the minimality condition doesn't apply, which is sort of like the one that people were least likely to question. And another example that he gave is that North Korea is more like China than China is like North Korea. And he found this by actually asking people which things are more like others, and finding that actually more people would say that this relation holds in this direction than the other one. And there's some other examples you can come up with here. He also gave the example where people judge their friends to be more like themselves than they judge themselves to be like their friends. Another example is Barnes & Noble is more like Amazon.com than Amazon.com is like BarnesandNoble.com. So these are sort of intuitively seem appealing, and when you actually ask humans, that's what you find. So that says that maybe similarity is not a symmetric relationship. So we have three axioms up there, they're all gone. Okay, so what's the right idea here? There's some other idea going on, but it ain't geometry. Now, it turns out that geometric models aren't dead. In the psychology literature, you'll actually find a fair amount of work dedicated to still studying these geometric models. The latest version of this would be multidimensional scaling. And it perhaps applies for many things which are inherently spatial or visual. So you might think that a dog is like a horse because they both have four legs, they both walk on four legs, they both have fur, they have some things in common to them. But part of that is embedded in our visual mindset, our visual perception of them. And so it could be that this actually works very well for things like image similarity. And in fact, there's a paper that came out on the Google Research webpage recently about a group who did image similarity, and they came to very different conclusions than I did. So I think actually what's happening here is that when something actually has a spatial component to it, the geometric models might make sense, but it doesn't make sense for the pure knowledge model. So it turns out Tversky came up with a completely different model, a completely way of thinking about this, where things are characterized by the features that they have. And this is actually one of the reasons why people think of themselves as being less like their friends than they think of their friends as being like themselves, because people have a very rich model of themselves. They know everything about themselves. They know all of their characteristics, and they can account for all of their characteristics. And when they make the similarity comparison, they take those characteristics and they say, does that person have those characteristics? But when you think about whether somebody else is similar to you, you actually have a very limited model of them. You don't know all of the features. And so those features are actually, the feature sets are different. And that's why it's actually asymmetric. There's some other models here. I don't have time to mention all these. Curiously, one of them actually has the acronym SIAM. You're wondering where this is none of those parsimony problems. But Tversky came up with a set of five axioms that similarity measures should satisfy. And I don't want to go through these in great detail because I just don't have enough time to spend on them. But these are all grounded in his observations from doing human experiments and in observing measures that actually people have tried to write down. So in particular, this first one sort of characterizes the method that the similarity of A to B is purely a function, some unknown function, of the set of characteristics that A and B share, the set of characteristics that A has that B does not have, and the set of characteristics that B has that are not possessed by A. And so he said axiom one is that these are the only things that matter for assessing similarity. The second one is a monotonicity statement, which basically says that if you expand these sets of characteristics, then you get more similarity or less similarity when applied in the right way. And so that one was sort of an obvious mathematical characteristic that you want to have for consistency. An independence judgment that said that the joint effect of any two of these sets should not influence the third. Then he had a solvability one, which said that every object is completely determined by its set of features. This one is a little suspicious because throughout this discussion, he doesn't actually say what a feature is. He leaves that completely out in the open. So a feature is anything you can observe, which is not completely helpful, but it's a good starting point mathematically. And he has this other one, too, which I'm not going to spend too much detail on. But he proved a theorem in his paper that's very interesting. He said that any similarity measure that satisfies these five axioms can be written down in this formula, which is the similarity from A to B is some function, some constant times a function of the characteristics in common with A and B, minus alpha times some other constant here, times a function of the characteristics shared possessed by A but not by B, and then another constant times some salience function on the features possessed by B but not A. And these functions F, they're what he called salience measures, which are somehow a measure of the intensity of the feature for this instance. And He predicted that actually alpha is bigger than beta because the features that are actually possessed by A are probably more important in this judgment. It's like that example I gave of when you judge your similarity to your friends, that the features of A are actually probably more important than the features of B in this judgment, which is why we expect this relationship on the constants. So I wrote this thing down. It turns out, when I went back to look at Dean and Hunzinger's paper on the co-citation model, they're using something very similar to this. They actually present two algorithms in the paper, and the algorithms were actually different than what we were using in production, but they were very close. So you can think of, if you're trying to assess similarity for these URLs over here, you can think of the pages that cite these URLs as being somehow features associated to these URLs. So there are a lot of different ways you could try to define a salience measure for these feature sets. But clearly, if this thing points off to a lot of other things, it has characteristics that are not shared by others. That this has characteristics that are not shared by this one, for example, right? Because it's also associated to other things. And so if you think about how you would actually define a salience measure on these relationships, one way to do it, one very simple way to do it, is just count the parents that you have in common, and then count the parents that you don't have in common for the two. And then you can construct a measure with just a pure counting function there. It actually doesn't do too bad, strangely enough. And it's very close to Tversky's original model. And they didn't even know about Tversky's model at the time they make this up. They're just doing some ad hoc construction that happened to work pretty well in those days. You could think of other variations of this. You could do it by proximity of links, how close they are in the document. If the two links are very close to each other, you might enhance the salience because they're likely talking about the same thing within that part of the document if you have two links going off very close to each other. You could also define other kinds of things which are sort of more like the PageRank type of model using random walks. You could talk about the hitting time if you were starting at A and you were walking in this graph. Can I go back? Probably not. Hello. Yeah. If you were starting here and you were walking back and forth on this graph, you could talk about the time, the hitting time, if you started here before you ended here. How long would you have to wait in expected time before you got there? You could also talk about other measures. This is the probability of hitting B in two steps from A. You could talk about probability measures on this random walk phenomenon. And so there are a lot of different variations on this theme, but you still got this basic mathematical model to guide you in making them up. But it turns out that there's some other stuff going on here. Why just use co-citation? Why just use citing URLs? There are a lot of features that documents have. In particular, we never even talked about looking at the documents themselves, what terms are in the documents. And you can think of the terms themselves as being features of the document. And so you could do the same kind of thing on this graph, which is you just walk to the term nodes and then walk back to the documents. And if you do that kind of random walk, then you're likely to end up in documents that are actually very close because you're walking to terms that are actually shared with the document that you started from. And so actually don't think this graph is representative of the things on the right-hand side, but I'll leave that as an exercise for the listener to come up with the right graph. So if you look at other kinds of features that might be associated, there's the ones I mentioned, the co-citation, the terms. Another very strong feature is anchor text. So if I put text on the page that's in blue and underlined, you all have another one of those Pavlovian reactions when I click on that, right? Because this is a signal to you that that is a link to something, right? And what happens is this text here that's in blue is called anchor text for that link. And what it is you can think of, when I write something like this, I tend to write this as a very brief summary of what that page is when you get there. That text is actually the strongest signal that exists on the World Wide Web for trying to say what that document is about. And so that turns out to be, well, this is well known in the information retrieval literature, that looking at this kind of text is more important than looking at other kind of text in the document. You could also look at features which are clicks. I told you before that we record a lot of information about what happens when users come there. So if you have a user that comes and types a query and then clicks on two separate documents for the same query, that's a very strong evidence that they actually think that these two are related for the same original concept that they had in mind. And so that's another kind of common feature. There's another one which is co-visitation. If a user visits two pages within a very brief period of time, that's another kind of link formed between them. And so you can link them through users being the other nodes in the bipartite graph. Now the real hard part comes in, how do you merge these signals together? I've drawn this colored graph here where I've got the URLs on one side, and each color represents a class of vertices associated to these documents. And so I've got citing URLs, tying them together, I've got terms tying them together, I've got queries, users, clicks, common queries, all sorts of different features which you might tie them together with. But the problem is that these colors over here, these labels on the bipartite graph, are actually very incomparable to each other. And in particular, the weights that you might associate to these edges are completely incomparable to each other. So it's not completely obvious how you would construct a random walk on this graph going back and forth, because the weights that you would take in one direction would probably be different than the weights you would take in another direction. So that's one of the techniques we actually thought about to try, is just to try a before I get to that random walk, there's this other thing I wanted to mention, is that each one of these signals has a lot of noise associated with it. So people can create all sorts of junk nodes over here. There's just a huge amount of noise going on in this, so you can't trust any one particular one too much. You have to do this on a statistical basis. So if I insert the word Klingon to this document, it doesn't actually mean it's related to anything in Star Trek, right? I just have some synaptic failure and type that. You can also create all sorts of off-topic links, right? There's all sorts of noise going on there. But hopefully, the noise in these signals is sort of independent of each other. These different kinds of signals have different kind of noise. So there are sort of two approaches we came up with. One is what's called a non-reversible random walk, where when you walk to the left in this graph, you actually use one set of weights, one rule for deciding which one to go to, which would be, say, you select a color and then select a random one of that color and walk to it. And then when you come back the other way, you have weights associated with them which are actually consistent within the same color. And so you would follow you would choose an edge going to the right, which was in some way proportional to those weights. Another way of doing it actually draws on something else, which is like completely from left field, which is this issue from the economics literature about rank aggregation. This is the thing that we actually implemented. But I don't think there's a right answer for this. Let me just tell you this last bit about what we implemented. So if you think about election theory, you may have heard of this famous theorem by Kenneth Arrow, that there cannot be an election system that obeys these five natural axioms for what you think an election system should behave in. A lot of the literature in this election theory is to try to come up with a system where if you have independent voters ranking lists of candidates, you can come up with a consistent ranking that in some way is faithful to the individual rankings of the individual voters. Now, most of the economics literature, they'll talk about a small number of candidates and a large number of voters. In this case, what we're thinking of is we have a large number of candidates, which are all the documents, and the number of voters is the number of signals that we have, which might be five or six. But we have these ranked lists, so this one might be the ranked list from co-citation, this might be the ranked list from the terms, where we order the document IDs according to some signal. And we know that we have noise in each one of these, so the co-citation is going to throw something in there that might be inappropriate. But it's very unlikely that something that's bad in this list is going to appear in another list if this independence criteria holds. So when you merge these together, hopefully if you come up with some ranking which in some ways is faithful to the individual rankings, you'll come up with a ranking which is overall the best you can come up with. And there's actually a fair amount of mathematics that goes into analyzing these things. It turns out that one measure is to minimize the number of inversions from the final ranking here to get to any of these individual rankings. It turns out that from a computer science point of view, calculating that ranking is NP complete. So that ain't likely to be something you can do. But there are approximation techniques you can apply, which actually a colleague of mine, I didn't mention his name on the first slide, but Siva Kumar actually had written a paper with some other colleagues where they actually worked on this problem of rank aggregation, came up with an approximation algorithm which gets approximately the minimum number of inversions and can be computed relatively efficiently. So that's actually the thing we came up with, is we look at these individual signals, we do some rank aggregation on them, throw out the things that actually don't occur in multiple lists, and try to merge them together. And the computer science is perhaps not so interesting here. There's massive calculations going on to do each one of these. So you get as input all the documents from the web, and you calculate this ranking for all the documents on the web according to co-citation, and then you do the same for all these other signals, and then you take those individual lists and you do perform the rank aggregation step, you get a final ranked list out, which is for each document, the top, say, 30, I think is what we calculated, of documents that are related to those. So I hope I've given you some flavor of what kind of mathematics I've encountered in this, and how you think about modeling this type of thing, and given you some message about what I see somehow as the future of applied mathematics for a large amount of applied mathematics that's going to be done in the next 10 years. I think you can see that mathematical modeling actually plays a very strong part in this information retrieval. We really don't have a clue how to build good mathematical models here. There's a lot of literature being written, a lot of ad hoc stuff being done, but not very strong ties of the mathematics to the actual methods that seem to work. Clearly, experimental measurement is crucial for success here. So if you think about that original message I gave about science and the activities that are going on, that experimental measurement part is a very big part of it. And we're just at the beginning of understanding this. It's just fumbling around days at this point. But at least the results are a little better now through some mathematics applied to that. Thank you very much for your attention.